Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Governor Mark Gordon reflects on this year's legislative session.
There was less regard for the Constitution this year, and in some cases, questioning whether the federal Constitution even applied.
Lawmakers were set to pick the topics they will spend the next few months hearing about from the public and stakeholders, but that didn't happen.
The motion that was made took me by surprise.
Now what? And a UW dean was removed from his position.
Donors say they're losing confidence in the university because of a lack of transparency about decisions like these.
We'll dig into the backstory. Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
As a listener to Wyoming Public Radio, you know that a significant portion of our news coverage is dedicated to local stories. We're committed to keeping you informed about what's happening right here in our communities. From city council meetings to neighborhood initiatives, we're here to show you the local impact of national events and the national scope of local issues. Support from our local community allows us to maintain this vital local focus, bringing you stories that matter most to you and your neighbors. So why does your support matter? Because in an era of shrinking local news coverage, Wyoming Public Media remains committed to telling our community's stories. Your membership ensures we can keep our reporters on the ground, uncovering the stories that shape our daily lives. So, join us as a monthly member today. It's quick and easy, and you'll be playing a crucial role in sustaining quality local journalism. Call us during our upcoming pledge drive or visit wyomingpublicmedia.org to start your membership today. Together, we can keep our community informed, engaged, and thriving.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Controversial bills were the norm in the recent legislative session. Governor Mark Gordon let some pass into law without his signature while still airing his frustration in so-called no-sign letters. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements caught up with the governor to ask him about his thoughts on the end of the session when the legislative rubber met the road.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Governor Gordon.
Chris, it's wonderful to be here. I have a chance to talk to you.
So my first question is, what do you see as the high points and the low point of the recent legislative session?
I was thinking about that, the good, the bad, and the ugly movie. And I think there's a lot of good that we come out of the session with. But there were some ugly parts, a little bit of sniping between the various groups. I think, you know, kind of setting up to we're just going to oppose whatever the governor's doing. It sort of started the process, which seemed pretty shallow to me when you really talk about what's important for Wyoming. I think the fact that legislature completely missed the issue of OB care that is so important to Wyoming mothers, and the fact that it's getting harder and harder to find good quality OB care in state, which then causes issues for people having to travel out of state at some expense. And when you consider how many of our births are their Medicaid births, and so that was a challenge. Completely sidestepping and missing mental health issues. I think that was problematic. I think people can feel pretty good about the fact that the legislature, after having pushed so many measures on property tax, they're seeing that this year. I don't think what they fully understood, and I think this is going to be a continuing issue, is what that did to local communities. I think people have got to understand how important it is that local communities have the ability to choose their own taxes and to be able to support the infrastructure and not depend on the state.
You wrote some scathing letters disagreeing with the legislature and the Secretary of State. Let's dig into them. 9 bills became law without your signature, the most during your tenure as governor. One requires voters to show proof of citizenship and that they've lived in Wyoming for 30 days. You've noted there's friction between this law and the U.S. Constitution, and you expect this new law will be litigated. Why let it go into law if you have these reservations and are confident in the way the state runs elections?
As I said, I've been confident in the way state runs elections. I've voted here for over 50 years. The security is very tight, and it's never been particularly an issue. There has been a lot of concern raised nationally about the security of our elections, I support any effort to make them more secure, more clear. The one issue that you referred to, which is the reason I couldn't sign it, was the fact that there is a statute that has a duration requirement. I think it's been tested in a few states. It may stand up. I don't know. And I'll just say overall, I think there was less regard for the Constitution this year, more regard by particularly some of the new, more ideologic legislators to push a national agenda or, model legislation that's been drafted somewhere else without regard to the Wyoming Constitution, and in some cases, questioning whether the federal Constitution even applied.
But I guess with that bill, my question is then, why not sign it outright or veto it and let the legislature override if they had the votes?
That's certainly a possibility. I have tried on the no sign letters always to say, here are the flaws that I see. I still think the bill has merit, but I think the flaw, this is the reason I can't sign it. That's the way I've looked at it. Now, maybe others in the past have said, I don't want to have my signature on it or anything else. I think the fact you put a letter there shows that you made a very conscious decision.
Okay, another bill, the banning most gun-free zones in the state. In your no-sign letter for that bill, you wrote that, and I'm paraphrasing, that it was a legislative power grab. And I've heard criticism from other people in addition to you about bills this session eroding local control more broadly, and not just in gun control, that area. So could you talk to me about your motivation for this one?
The legislature really was anxious to say, this is our deal, we're going to control it. We're now trying to figure out how to deal with the circumstances that come afterwards on that bill. The reason that I was as anxious to make sure that that point was made was because I do think that the legislature really needed to understand that this was more than just a Second Amendment's bill. This was something that was going to be complicating for people's behaviors. I knew that there was no way that I would be able to sustain a veto.
But then what would you say, Governor, to someone who might go up to you and tell you, I appreciate you writing that no sign letter and expressing your concerns, but at the same time, talk is cheap and you could have vetoed this. You could have taken action. What would you say to someone who might have that opinion?
Take a look at the majorities by which that bill passed in each house. It really wouldn't have made a difference. My interest is not sort of a show. My interest is to demonstrate responsible policies moving forward.
One last question about the interim looking forward. People are quite concerned with the point of an interim at this point, and I'm wondering if you share those concerns with all these committee bills being killed.
Yeah, I do. You look at the history of the last couple of sessions where so much of that work that is thoughtful, that is accessible to people in the state, because a lot of these committee meetings happen remotely, that there really is deliberate conversation, and those things die. And I think there's a benefit to committee work. I think if you're not going to take the work at its value and you're going to substitute it right before the session, I think that's kind of disappointing for the state of Wyoming.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Governor. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Governor Mark Gordon talking about the recent legislative session with Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements. Wyoming lawmakers spend the time in between sessions researching, studying, and learning about topics they think are important to the state. This interim period usually ends with draft bills that are introduced during the next session. But it's been questioned quite a bit in the last couple of years, and it just got a pretty big makeover. Here with me to make sense of all of this are our two state government reporters, Chris Clements and Jordan Eplinger. Thanks for being here, you two.
Yes, it's a beautiful day to be talking politics, y'all.
We're in the station, but it does look like a very nice day outside.
It is a nice day. So earlier this week, you both went to Cheyenne for a management council meeting. Why was this an important meeting to go to?
Well, our understanding was that in this meeting, the council, which is made up of 10 House and Senate leaders, would approve proposed topics by each legislative committee so we could move forward with the interim process.
Right. And I think most lawmakers thought that was going to happen as well. Before the meeting, Democratic Jackson Representative Mike Yin went on his social media to explain how the day would work, starting with committee chairs, listing their priorities for topics and meeting dates.
Management Council, who hears that, is in charge of deciding how our nonpartisan legislative service office is managed. And so that's why we determine how long we should be meeting, how many days we should be meeting, so we manage that budget appropriately.
Right. Former Freedom Caucus Chair Gillette Representative John Baer also explained the point of this meeting in a social media video asking his constituents to weigh in on topics they want committees to consider.
And we will be selecting the subjects that we will study in our select committees as well as our standard committees. So I'm seeking your input because we really want to be the representatives of you, the people.
But it turns out that some lawmakers had a different idea. Majority Floor Leader Senator Tara Nethercott of Cheyenne brought a motion in the first 16 minutes of the meeting for cutting the numbers of days committees meet from 6 to 4, saying it'll save taxpayers money. She also advocated that committee chairs, not the management council, should decide which topics their committees pick up in the interim.
It's about $120,000 to $140,000 that we can save the taxpayers of Wyoming to reduce the amount of interim committee days from 6 to 4.
It's worth noting the motion said committee chairs can request more than 4 days from the council if they can justify them.
Okay, and what was Nethercott's reasoning to make this pretty big change?
There were a couple. Cost savings, like she said, was a big one. Also, in the past few years, a lot of the work that lawmakers do during the interim hasn't translated to new policy. And she basically said some parts of the interim process amount to wasted time. In some cases, like during the budget session in 2024, a concerted effort was made to kill committee bills by members of the Freedom Caucus.
I too am frustrated with this process and find it wildly inefficient, where we're going to spend about 12 hours today having chairmen read their interim topic letters.
Kind of sounds like she's saying this meeting could have been an email.
Right. And even with the attempt to make things more efficient, I found it interesting the council meeting ended up lasting 10 and a half hours.
The agenda set us up for a long day for sure. Until recently, bills drafted by interim committees more often than not became law. That's because they'd been studied, vetted, and included testimony from the public and experts that lawmakers heard throughout the summer months. But last year, we saw the highest percentage of committee bills fail to be introduced since 2000. And this year, the lowest number of committee bills became law, not even half.
So some lawmakers are asking, is the interim a waste of time and money? Laramie Democratic Senator Chris Rothfuss summed it up pretty well.
The House basically left, 15 committee bills in the drawer. So I do understand the frustration of some members of the Management Council that if we're not actually going to be able to introduce our committee bills, why would we spend so much time during the off-season working on the committee bills?
It was actually 14 committee bills, by the way, but still.
Okay, and did the motion to shake things up succeed?
Question has been called. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. Motion has been adopted.
Yes, it did. Most committees will have only 4 interim days, which will likely mean some will need to cut down on the number of topics they tackle. These changes are intended to save money, but that's having its own effect on the behavior of committee chairs. With frugality in mind, some of them are planning on changing their meeting locations too, even though that isn't what the council explicitly required.
And even though it passed, not everyone was happy.
The motion that was made took me by surprise.
That's Senator Stephen Pappas of Cheyenne. He chairs the Transportation Committee. His committee spends a lot of time during the interim touring transportation and military sites around the state to educate its members and have FaceTime with citizens.
Well, frankly, I think cutting down interim time is going to make for poorer legislation, not better. And I think it was a knee-jerk reaction to what happened this last year, the drop in number of bills that passed. I don't think we'll see that next year.
Pappas said if committees aren't going to hear from the public around the state, maybe they shouldn't meet at all, and task forces should pick up the work. Democratic Senator Chris Rothfuss from Laramie also said he was not happy at all about the loss of FaceTime with constituents.
When we reduce the number of days during the interim, we are directly reducing their access to their legislators in the most meaningful part of the process. Now, if what we're admitting to is that the process itself during the interim through our committee work doesn't work any longer, then maybe we all need to just go freelance a little bit and act as individual legislators working on individual bills.
Freedom Caucus member John Baer wasn't pleased either. He suggested this change is a political move, made only after his caucus gained a majority in the House.
When more moderate or progressive legislators are meeting and discussing moderate and progressive subjects, more time is allotted. But then when conservatives have the majority, we want to restrict the opportunity to study conservative issues.
Baer said he was worried that with a reduction in meeting time, his Appropriations Committee now won't have enough space to tackle fire mitigation programs. And he said the reason so many committee bills died this and last year was because more moderate Republicans were in the driver's seat choosing interim topics, which the further right Freedom Caucus majority then opposed. He doesn't think that'll happen moving forward.
And I would anticipate that through the next interim, you have a conservative group picking the topics and voting on the topics or bills in the next session. So I would expect the percentage to return to a higher number.
But it did pass. So what were people saying who were in support?
Democratic Representative Ivan Posey of Fort Washakie said the changes probably won't affect the Tribal Relations Committee.
We scheduled 4 days anyway. It really empowers me. You know, I was like, now we could... Senator Case and I, Chairman Case and I could sit down and say, let's see what's really, you know, what we really want to tackle in this short time that we have.
Okay, so we headed into this meeting thinking we would know what topics the interim committees would concentrate on. When is that going to happen now?
Well, committee chairs need to send their revised list of interim topics to the Management Council for final sign-off sometime before April 22nd. The council will then resolve any topics that crop up in more than one committee.
Another big change that came out of this meeting that I just want to mention quickly is lawmakers approved using state funds to send themselves to meetings of a conservative policy group. Usually, these trips are for nonpartisan conferences like the Council of State Governments or the National Conference of State Legislators. But now, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC as it's commonly known, is also approved. That group drafts model bills on subjects like tightening voter ID laws, opposing labor unions and gun control, and cutting taxes and regulations.
Okay, well, Chris and Jordan, thank you so much for explaining this pretty complicated process. And we will hear from both of you at the end of the month when we know what the interim is going to concentrate on.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Looking forward to it as well.
Up next, we dig into why a University of Wyoming dean was let go. This is Open Spaces.
Season 10 of The Modern West is called The Gray in Between. Episode 1 starts us off with a conversation with economist Samuel Western about how the West got so darn black and white.
We've always had a thing against the federal government, but the late 70s and 80s really stuck in people's craw, and it didn't go away.
A pluralistic mindset. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by the Equality State Policy Center.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. A quick note before we dive into this story. Wyoming Public Media is a licensee of the University of Wyoming, but operates as an editorially independent news organization. Faculty at the University of Wyoming issued a no-confidence vote in the university's president. It comes on the heels of an abrupt firing of a popular dean, which drew backlash from donors and some lawmakers. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor has been investigating deteriorating relationships within the university over the past few months for his online news outlet, The Laramie Reporter. He shares the findings from his public records request with us now. Hey, Jeff.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with the latest. UW President Ed Seidel will keep his job, but without the support of the Faculty Senate.
That's right. During a special meeting, the Faculty Senate voted overwhelmingly, 43-11, to say they had lost confidence in Seidel's presidency.
Okay, so how did we get here?
Earlier this month, UW announced it was demoting Cameron Wright, who had been the dean of the College of Engineering for 6 years. By most accounts, he was a popular dean. His department heads liked working with him, and so did the faculty. But he had grown unpopular with some university leaders.
And why was that?
Allow me to give you some backstory. So starting in 2012, Wyoming launched something called the Tier 1 Engineering Initiative. Basically, it's this big push to make UW one of the very best engineering schools in the country. There was a task force that set out goals, and the state gave UW a lot of money to make this happen.
And Dean Wright was in charge of overseeing this initiative.
That's right. And late last month, he was called before the university's board of trustees to explain his progress. Wright said it's been bumpy.
Since the Tier 1 Engineering Initiative started, we've been through 5 deans, 6 provosts, and 6 presidents. And that does make things a little challenging, you might say, but we have persevered.
Wright also provided a report that was several hundred pages long, outlining his progress in even greater detail. But the trustees were not impressed. Trustee Carol Linton said the report failed to give her a picture of where the Tier 1 Engineering Initiative actually stands.
I expected to get a clear update. Instead, we got 356 pages of a document dump.
The board told Wright to return in May with better measures for his progress. But a few days later, the trustees met again, this time in private, and decided to remove Wright as the leader of the engineering college. They didn't give much of an explanation, but they did say it was related to Tier 1 progress. The demotion was pretty shocking to a lot of people on campus, though I was not surprised that he was on the hot seat.
And why is that?
Because I was reading his emails.
Tell me why.
To be clear, the emails I was reading came from a bunch of public records requests I submitted to the university a few months ago, when UW leaders ousted a different administrator, the former provost, Kevin Carman. Carman, just like Wright, was abruptly removed mid-semester with little in the way of a public explanation. And I wanted to find out why. I still can't say for sure why he was removed. Neither Carman nor the university has publicly stated why. But I did start to uncover an interesting exchange between Carman, Wright, and state lawmakers.
What did you find out?
So in addition to the Tier 1 initiative, UW has also been expanding its computing capabilities. In an age of supercomputers and AI and interdisciplinary research requiring sophisticated computing abilities, UW is in the process of launching a school of computing. Right now, that school is nested within the College of Engineering, but UW plans to separate them. But funding has been a problem. UW requested $5 million for the school back in 2023. The governor and the state legislature rejected that request, even as they boosted funding for Tier 1 engineering. So UW started taking some of that Tier 1 funding and giving it to the School of Computing.
And is that allowed?
Well, UW says it's using that money to support things like faculty positions that involve both computing and engineering work. So it's advancing the Tier 1 goals while also helping the School of Computing get on its feet. And as long as the School of Computing is housed in the College of Engineering, this transfer is staying within the college, and no one's upset about it. The problem arises as UW plans to move the School of Computing out of the college. If this $500,000 is going to keep supporting the School of Computing, it's now going to have to leave the College of Engineering.
And former Dean Cameron Wright didn't like that.
He did not. In the emails I saw, he fights the transfer, saying that as dean, he has to look out for the best interests of his college and follow the law. UW administrators even ask him to sign a memorandum approving the transfer, and he refuses. At this point, lawmakers are starting to look into the matter. Laramie's representative Carly Provenza and Senator Chris Rothfuss even sent a letter to the governor and the UW Board of Trustees objecting to the transfer. That letter also calls Wright's leadership principled, and it warns UW not to retaliate against him.
So the lawmakers were concerned that Wright could be fired over this?
They were definitely concerned. And I should say, UW is no longer going to make this transfer. But the nature of this dispute between Wright and other UW leaders, a lot of folks on campus wonder whether it played into the decision to remove the dean.
Have you found anything definitive about that claim?
We can't really say. And that is really the core of the problem, as donors and faculty see it. Donors say they're losing confidence in the university because of a lack of transparency about decisions like these. And faculty say these decisions are being made under a shroud of secrecy. Everyone is circling this idea of transparency and shared governance, or the idea that UW leaders should consider input from all corners of campus, faculty, staff, students, others. And they're saying UW President Ed Seidel, and maybe even the whole board, are failing to live up to those principles.
So how deep do these concerns go? Are donors pulling funding?
Pretty deep. On the day UW announced Wright's removal, one major fundraiser said it was pausing its support. And in another email that's been shared with me, the executive director for the School of Energy Resources estimated that UW had lost $5 million in current and potential donations in just 3 days.
Wow. And then the no confidence vote in President Seidel. So how has he reacted?
Seidel hosted a public town hall just hours before the faculty vote. He stressed that Wright's removal was not retaliation for the transfer, but declined to explain further, saying it was a personnel issue discussed in private. He also promised to do better.
Okay, and how did the trustees respond to all of this?
The morning after the town hall and the faculty vote, the trustees announced they would start a new committee. This committee doesn't have members yet, but the idea is that it will create better communication channels and help UW get back to shared governance. Faculty are cautiously optimistic. Political science professor Greg Cowley said the vote was about forcing a conversation. If the new committee does that, he's all in.
I think it's a very good first step, and we'll still, you know, have to see how that plays out.
But I should note that Seidel's contract expires next summer, and the board will have to approve a new contract with Seidel to keep him.
All right. Well, thanks for unpacking that, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
More than 100 members of the Wyoming Bar Association are calling on the state's congressional delegation to denounce threats to judges and support the independence of the judicial branch. Former Wyoming Supreme Court Chief Justice Marilyn Kite talked with me about what judges are facing, why name-calling can be so damaging, and how the public can help. Marilyn Kite, thank you for being here with me today. What type of attacks or threats were you guys referring to? What stood out to you? A specific event or comment that prompted you to sign this letter?
The event that prompted the letter, I think, was the attack on the federal judge who decided the case involving the Trump administration deportation of allegedly Venezuelan gang members. Mm. I don't know much about the facts of the case, but I do know that the response was to vilify a federal judge for the decision that he made.
And why was that something that's worrisome for you and other Wyoming members of the bar?
There are many judges over the country, not just federal judges, but state judges, who have been the victims of some kind of violent action, whether it be at their homes or threats on the telephone, in some cases brandishing of weapons. That was probably the primary reason. But the underlying position that shows is that when a judge makes a legal decision, which is his or her job to do, the other side doesn't like it, then they are attacked personally and essentially wanting to throw out the system. It causes the public to think that that's what we do. If we don't like a judicial decision, we just call them a crook or a crazy or what's the term they used? Rogue. They're a rogue judge if they decide against me. And that's damaging to our constitutional system.
And in the letter, you guys specifically called out the, quote, disinformation in form of attacks on judges who have ruled against DOJ's unprecedented actions, unquote. So my understanding is it's the most recent decisions in regards to Trump's administration's actions, EOs.
Yes, that's right. There have been multiple decisions across the country on different aspects of the recent attempts to change our government.
What about this current political environment feels different?
Well, everything. You know, as I grew up and went to law school and practiced law, of course you're upset with a decision that is adverse to the cause that you're pursuing in court. Mm. But certainly as long as I served on the Wyoming Supreme Court for 15 years, there were several or multiple decisions that were controversial, certainly to the parties before us, but I never had any suggestion, any email, anything from an individual citizen or a lawyer or anybody involved in the case. I knew some were unhappy with us, but when you ask somebody to serve in that capacity to resolve the disputes in our society, there's always two parties in the case or there is no case. So if you don't respect the decision and go about your business and do what you have to do with that ruling, it really does weaken and threaten the structure of our government, both state and federal.
Right, that respect for the judiciary has kind of been expected.
Exactly, and we had always, not so much as joked, but commented that, not we, the Wyoming judges, just judges in general, the judiciary is the weakest branch of government. Mm. We can't raise an army, and we can't raise taxes. All we can do is make decisions. And not only do our rights depend on that, our constitutional rights, but the stability of our society and our commerce and our, you know, the lives, individual lives of people depend upon the fact that there is a referee at the end of a dispute. We might be mad at the referee for a while, but if we don't have a referee, we can't have a society. We can't have a basketball game. We can't have a football game. We'd have a melee. And so our founding fathers knew that was important and established the judicial branch, which is simply doing its job.
So this letter was sent at the end of March, and you asked Senators Lummis and Barrasso and Representative Hageman to publicly condemn these threats, affirm judicial independence, and remind Americans that appeals, not intimidation or violence, are the constitutional remedy for a court ruling that they disagree with. What have you heard back?
Well, I personally haven't heard anything back. I don't know if I have not heard that the main author has heard anything back. So I think it's been pretty quiet.
And what does that signal to you?
I'm not sure. I'd like to think it doesn't signal that they disagree or they'd be arguing back.
Are there any next steps that you and the other signers of the letters are thinking of taking?
There's a lot of discussion, and the signers of the letter are all lawyers and judges, retired or currently serving. No currently serving judge signed the letter. And we're brainstorming what the next step would be. We think it's important that, you know, some of this seems pretty esoteric to the public. What are these people arguing about? And it's important. Frankly, civics education hasn't gotten the attention that it should have for decades. The civics education is the least funded in the elementary and secondary education. And I know that I can't cite you the source of that, but I know it's a reliable one.
Is that in Wyoming or in the state, in the nation?
I'm talking Wyoming, but okay. I'll bet it's reflective of the rest of the country. It just hasn't gotten the attention that it should. And it's hard to teach. We are trying to figure out how to do that in a constructive way across the state, whether it's informational meetings, you know, whether it's working with the schools, professional organizations to try to communicate the importance of this problem. We'll keep being a voice to try to lower the heat in the discussions regarding judicial decisions.
Got it. So education,
it's education.
People.
It's slow and it's painful, but that's all we can see to do.
Is there anything else you'd want to mention?
Well, I would like to say just to the citizens that this is your problem. It's not the judge's problem. If you don't defend the independence of the judiciary and their role, then there's nobody to decide the dispute except the one that's louder and stronger and has more money, and that affects your lives.
Well, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you.
That was former Supreme Court Chief Justice Marilyn Kite speaking about the threats to the judicial branch. I check in with Wyoming Public Radio's general manager about the station's funding situation. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. As the Trump administration and DOGE reshape federal funding, public radio has been in the news alongside national parks, public health, and the weather service. We asked Wyoming Public Media's general manager, Christina Kuzmich, to talk us through how the station is funded and how changes and probes at the federal level are affecting your local public radio station. So Wyoming Public Media's annual budget is about $4 million. Where does that money come from?
It comes from a variety of sources. The biggest one is members and major donors. That's 46% of our operating funds. Corporate underwriters is 14%. Corporation for Public Broadcasting is 13%. UW is 25%. So that makes up the budget.
Got it. What does this station's CPB grant cover?
Programming and operations are the main things. Just about all aspects of public broadcasting have CPB money attached to them. It's part of the fabric. For example, if you listen to Morning Edition and All Things Considered, that's paid for by CPB money. If you listen to the reports from the State House and the two reporters we just had this year, that's funded by Corporation for Public Broadcasting. If you drive through Wyoming, you can pick up Wyoming Public Radio just about every place in the state. That statewide connectivity is funded by CPB.
Can you clarify to the listeners exactly what CPB is, what Corporation for Public Broadcasting is?
CPB is a private nonprofit corporation. It was authorized by Congress in 1967 when the Public Broadcasting Act was brought about. Now, here's how it works. CPB appropriates money to stations, and stations then do their broadcasting activities. They support close to 400 public radio stations, and most importantly, they make sure that rural stations are funded, and Wyoming is all rural.
So they help with the infrastructure money.
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of antennas and satellites. We have 46 sites because we serve all of Wyoming. So all of that equipment and the satellite interconnection for those sites is funded by CPB.
Got it. And just jumping back, you also mentioned that we have about 25% of our budget from the University of Wyoming. So what does the money coming from UW offer?
UW has two sources of money that it offers to us, direct funding, and that funds half of our full-time salaries and benefits. The other part that it takes care of is indirect costs. For example, this studio that we're sitting in is university property. So our studios and our offices in Laramie and our main studio are funded by the University of Wyoming. They also fund some of our sites, for example, Pilot Hill, which serves Laramie and Cheyenne, that is on university ground.
And WPM is licensed by UW. What does that mean?
The trustees of the university hold the license. So we are an institutional licensee. And most of the stations in the United States are owned by universities.
But we are editorially independent from them.
Yes, we have to be. That's part of the license agreement, is that we serve the public and not the institution that licenses us.
Okay. And what are you hearing about CPB funding, both for Wyoming Public Media and more broadly right now?
Well, it's in question, and some would say it's in peril. For example, on March 26th, the DOGE subcommittee, chaired by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, called for the complete defunding and dismantling of NPR and PBS. Recently, the FCC chair started out by issuing a statement that he believes the public broadcasting doesn't merit public support. We watched the dismemberment of the Voice of America. We watched how AP was treated over the Gulf of Mexico versus the Gulf of America issue. So that has us rattled. Now, because CPB is funded by Congress, we're used to having to justify ourselves every time there's an election or budget appropriations are in discussion. Both parties use public broadcasting as a lightning rod issue to gin up their bases, and we get it. We understand that. This administration, however, is a little different. So our level of concern is a little higher.
Okay. And at the top, we mentioned underwriting as part of our budget, and the chair of the Federal Communications Commission has been investigating whether public TV and radio stations are airing advertisements in violation of federal guidelines. Has WPM been notified it's being probed? And can you explain a bit how underwriting is different from advertising and why that's an important distinction?
Okay, I'll start from the big one. NPR and 13 stations have been notified by FCC, and they're providing their underwriting samples and practices to FCC as we speak. We have not heard anything from them. WPM hasn't. Now, the question of basic underwriting and advertising. Advertising on commercial stations has a lot of elements, including different voices, active and description language, music, jingles, sound effects. It has pricing information, and it can be read in a very loud voice. Underwriting on public radio is limited to naming client, their services, and their location, and it cannot have pricing information or comparative language. So, for example, you could say on public radio underwriting for this program comes from Jacobs General Motors dealership, offering the 2025 GMC Sierra and the Chevrolet Equinox, located in downtown Casper on Main Street. On commercial station, you would say, we're Jacobs General Motors. Come see our various lines of GMC Sierras. We offer unbeatable prices. We lower all our prices in Wyoming. Come check us out. First five customers will get a discount. That would be on commercial radio.
Okay. So there's an important distinction there.
There is a distinction, and part of that distinction is because we are federally funded.
Got it.
So we can't be competing with the commercial radio stations for clients.
Mm-hmm. And the president and other high-profile politicians have been saying public broadcasters shouldn't receive federal funding. What are you hearing from the public here in Wyoming, but also nationally, about tax dollars helping pay for these stations?
People in Wyoming on all sides of the issue are pretty supportive. Wyoming has always been supportive of public broadcasting, and we find that a lot of our donors come from both sides of the aisle. We don't see that much of a dislike for public broadcasting in Wyoming. Nationally, I would say it's pretty much the same. And the one way that you can really take a look at it is look at the way public broadcasting has been treated in budgeting sessions in Congress over the past decades. There's a lot of flurry, there's a lot of activity, a lot of language crosses paths, but in the end, it gets funded. Why? Because the politicians realize that the public likes public radio and public television, and that defunding it is not a good idea.
Okay. Well, Christina Kuzmich, Wyoming Public Radio's general manager, thank you for being here with me today.
Thank you for asking me.
Up next, our neighbors south of us are thinking that storing nuclear waste could be a good economic opportunity. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Hey. Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Northwest Colorado is losing coal jobs and dollars, similar to Wyoming. A small group in Colorado is raising the possibility of nuclear waste storage as a replacement. Wyoming's legislature will also likely consider storing spent nuclear fuel during this year's interim session. The Mountain West News Bureau's Scott Franz traveled west of Steamboat Springs, where he found mixed feelings about the region's economic future.
The ranching community of Hayden has been approached twice in the past by groups trying to sell them casinos to solve their financial challenges. Now residents are hearing about another big idea: importing toxic nuclear waste and creating the nation's first centralized storage site somewhere in the state's northwest corner. At this point, the project is an idea floating around political circles, but it's raising eyebrows at the Wild Goose, a cozy coffee shop in the center of town. I meet the Delaneys at a small table in the back.
Obviously a lot of concerns with transporting nuclear waste by rail.
Especially when we're in, to me, one of the more exciting discussions is commuter rail in our valley.
Especially if you're going to have passenger rail on the same lines. I mean, that's a big issue. But I guess I don't know enough about it.
Patrick and Tammy Delaney run this popular spot inside an old grain elevator, the tallest structure in Hayden. Train tracks run just outside this coffee shop. We don't know if these tracks would be used to import nuclear waste, and the facility wouldn't be in their town. Still, the Delaneys are worried.
What is the economic, value of that? I have no idea.
Nobody has been able to pinpoint that number yet. Like other towns in the area, Hayden is losing lots of coal jobs. Tammy says the waste idea doesn't fit with her town's core values.
To me, it's clean air, clean water, communities that know each other, that we know how to grow and raise our own food, and we know how to process it, and we know how to create amazing baked goods with.
Using federal dollars, county-level conversations about a possible nuclear storage facility were happening throughout the fall. Hayden's leaders here in Rout County haven't been at the table. They actually quit the group that's floating the idea about 4 years ago.
There is no political will in Rout County for a nuclear storage facility.
Tim Redmond represents Hayden as a county commissioner. He points to facilities like this one, the town's vibrant community center, as one of many signs the town can weather the coal transition without doing something like importing toxic waste. He says major train crashes are another reason to pass on the idea.
I mean, we see what can happen with a crude oil train. My God, what are we going to do with a nuclear waste accident?
Redmond points to new developments, like a business park going up at the regional airport, as signs Hayden is doing just fine.
If I look around at all the communities that are going through this transition, I think Hayden's doing the best.
But Hayden can afford to be more selective about its economic future than its neighbors eyeing nuclear waste. Here in Rout County, there's a strong tourism industry and a diverse economy centered in Steamboat Springs. Coal jobs are responsible for less than 15% of its economic output. But over in neighboring Moffat County, that number was almost 50% when the mines started closing. So there's a real sense of urgency here, as Sasha Nelson drives me around the outskirts of a small city called Craig. We're checking out a whirlwind of projects designed to help it survive the energy transition.
We're trying to do so much so fast.
Nelson is an economic development worker in this region. She talks about new affordable housing and a commercial solar array. Our first stop, though, is a brand new boat ramp on the Yampa River.
Others may spend time tubing in lower season. Others may come and find a nice fishing hole.
project leader Melanie Kilpatrick, who joined us at the boat ramp, says the goal here is to draw tourists.
Many, especially who are here in Moffett County, kind of want that wide open space and connection to nature.
After we hop back in Nelson's car and continue our tour, reality starts to sink in. How far will these projects really go in replacing coal revenue?
Not enough to replace the 2,800 jobs projected to have been, at risk in 2020 when closures were announced.
And that's where nuclear waste storage comes back in. Nelson has heard about it, but staring through the windshield at the vast mesas and fields of sagebrush, she says she doesn't want this region to become a dumping ground.
It would break my heart if, because of our remoteness, because of the space that we still have available, that becomes a place where any project just ends, where we're a waste disposal area.
But she understands why the talks are happening.
We need a next phase and the options for nuclear development. And those conversations are ongoing and are really critical for the what's next.
Nelson is focusing on what the region can do now, and for good reason. The federal government says even if Northwest Colorado puts in a bid for a nuclear waste storage facility, it would likely be a decade before it's built. Moffett County has hosted meetings about the idea of importing nuclear waste, and a report summarizing those meetings said there was no notable fear or hesitation to continuing them. Political action on the idea could come soon. State Senator Dylan Roberts represents Rout and Moffett counties. He's interested in a waste storage facility.
I have been a strong supporter for things like the boat ramp and the affordable housing development in Craig, which are all going to help diversify their economy and keep people in the community. But we do need to recognize that a big part of their tax base is energy development, and it should continue to be that way.
Back at the Wild Goose coffee shop in Hayden, the Delaneys say they're also intrigued by the idea of nuclear energy. But Patrick and Tammy aren't sold on what to do with the waste.
Well, most part it's safe.
I mean, skipped it, but...
But, you know, again, what do you do...
problem of waste.
What do you do in the long run, and how do you get it here? I think we have to see it be successful in other countries before we really see it deployed in the U.S.
And if these talks continue, they say they'll need to do a lot more research before evaluating this sales pitch. Scott Franz, KUNC.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, our audio producer today, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.